Thank you. And now is the time of the service when we launch into the actual program. We're very fortunate this morning to have, in addition to myself, three other speakers. We have Linda Shand, who is a nurse and is going to speak about her knowledge of Helen. We have a dear and old friend, Dorothy Bowman, who is going to speak. And we have Mike Heffernan, who is going to speak. So since I proposed this program back in May, I've had so many different thoughts about what it should be and how I should open it. One of the things that occurred to me as an opening is that Helen linked in with me. I don't know if you all know what LinkedIn is, but it's a social network kind of thing for professionals. Helen linked in with me some time ago. And, you know, I still get her coming up as being linked in with me when I looked at who I'm linked in with. And there's something to me very symbolic about that because I feel that I am still very much linked in with Helen. I've thought that because Helen is such a multi-dimensional person and there's so much to talk about, that there were just so many ways in which this could be approached and so many things that she was involved in. So I'd like to just begin with, for those of you who perhaps didn't know Helen, who are new to the fellowship, so that you'll get to have a better idea of her when we conclude, and for all of us who knew her and had her as part of this for so many years, that I hope it will be an opportunity for us to celebrate who she was, what she gave, not only to us, but to so many. So I was thinking about starting out with just one little exercise for all of you, and if you care to, actually, you can probably just call it out and I can hear you. If I went around the room and anybody felt so moved and there were one word that popped into your head to describe Helen, what would it be? Practical?
Tall.
Fair.
Fair.
Mentor.
Inspiring. Mentor.
Inclusive.
Talented. Generous. Caring.
Veteran.
Oh, veteran. Okay, veteran. Absolutely, veteran.
Very good.
Good, intelligent.
Nag.
What?
Nag.
Nag. Okay. And I'm going to add another one. Great sense of humor. I don't know how I put that into one word, but really... lot of sense of fun, a real, real great sense of fun. So I think she would have enjoyed hearing Kismet this morning. So that, I think, tells us that she is a multifaceted person, many dimensions, many elements, so many things that she did that it's just hard to get all of them into one thing. I asked Claire McNeil had hoped to be here, and Claire had written something, and I asked Claire to send it to me, and then the computer didn't work. Anyway, she went through this whole list of things and sent me every committee that Helen had ever been on. If those of you who know Claire will know that she knew this, every committee she'd been on, all the years that she had done it, all the different things that she had done. So if we listed them, I mean, it would just be in this enormous, enormous list, which we all know. So in so many words, yes, Helen was multidimensional. And we're going to have an opportunity to explore those dimensions this morning. Each of us who are going to speak, I think, are going to take something like perhaps five to 8 minutes to talk about our impressions of Helen. But I think that we can see Helen's legacy all around us. We can see it in the chairs we're sitting on, which are from Helen. We can see it in some of our books, some of the hymnals that we have. We can see it in the quilt. We can see it in the runner for the altar. And we can see it especially in the RE children who have grown up in this fellowship and now have their own children, and their children have gone on to be part of life and all that's happening. So as I said, on a personal level, and I guess why I wanted to do this is that Helen is my hero. She was bright, kind, understanding, logical, compassionate, realistic, and I concluded, just plain fun. She cared about making the world a better place, and she showed us that ordinary people can be heroes and can give us the inspiration to be better than we thought we could be, and that's a real gift for anybody to be able to do. She joined a group called PAPA, P-A-P-A. It's an interfaith pastors group in this area. When we had a minister who wasn't able to attend those meetings. And through that, she made so many connections and got us involved with so many different things. She got us involved with the Islamic Center up the road. She got us involved with some of the racial inequities in our community. She joined the funeral society, and she got us to think about the high and unnecessary cost of death. She was a nurse. She was a writer. She wrote a book that influenced generations of nurses. So I want to begin with something that I learned about Helen. I did an interview. We had a project. We had a small group ministry project back in 2006. And in that project, some of you may be here who were in that, we each selected, we wanted to remember and have information about some of the older members, the senior members in our fellowship. So each of us selected one member that we were going to interview, and then we were going to have this as part of an archive. My person was Helen. So I interviewed Helen back in 2006. And of all, I shared with Elaine this morning, it's very precious to me, so I don't want to give it up, but the manuscript of what I did, what I wrote after the interview, it's got all her editorial comments in it. I mean, she was an editor par excellence. She just didn't let one little thing go by. She had this whole editing thing. So I love it for that reason, and I keep it for that reason. But in that interview, I learned that one of the first big, exciting things for her in her work as a nurse was to read a story called The 11 Blue Men. And any of you here who might be nurses or involved in the scientific community know that The 11 Blue Men is a story from The New Yorker, which was published back, I think, in 1948. And in that story, there are 11 men who one day, not all at the same time, different times, are brought into the hospital in New York City. Many of them are from the Bowery. So it was traced back to the Bowery. It was traced back to a cafeteria where these men ate, which was an inexpensive place, which was why they were eating there. And it was traced back to the fact that all the men ate oatmeal that day. The crux of the story, as they went back and explored, was that the guy who was setting up the kitchen thought he was putting salt into the salt box, salt shaker, and it turned out to be, I don't know, I'm not a scientist, I don't know, sodium something that wasn't, it wasn't safe. Some of you here who are scientists probably know what it was. It turned the men blue. So when they first came in, they thought, oh, these are drunks. They didn't know what had happened to them, so they weren't that concerned. But then they started thinking, no, there's something odd here. And the whole process by which they went back and discovered what had turned the men blue, what had caused them all to have this problem, was this exciting thing for Helen, that it's the process of science, how you track back, how you find out how something happen, how you put all the facts together. Facts, not suppositions. You put the facts together and you figure out what happened. She used this. She told me that she used it in her teaching and she had her students work on it. And she wrote things about it as well. So that to me was rather intriguing, the 11 Blue Men. And it stands again as a symbol for me of that scientific analytical mind that she had that was combined with this kind of intuitive leap of understanding of and this great combination of both of these gifts. It shows me that Helen's love of logical, rational thinking and yet using intuitive insight to come up with a solution was a large part, again, of what she was. So I think I can't go into all the things, all the ways in which Helen influenced me and made me think about social concerns, working to make things better, being conscious of how other people are living, being concerned about how the people who have needs. She fed the men. She cooked meals for the men at the peak, at the Jan Peak shelter for years. She would cook real meals. These men didn't want noodles and pasta. They wanted meat food. So she made this. And I believe she did this with Ellen Bendix and a lot of other people here, too, worked with her on this. So she had so many commitments and so many things that she did. Somebody once in some group said to me, who is somebody that you all admire and that you all would like to be like? And people were naming different people, and we went around the room, and I jumped up and I started talking about Helen and all these things that she'd done. And people were just dumbfounded that someone could have that kind of impact, that kind of impact on making the world better. So to me, and I think to others, she's an inspiration to be better, to do better, and to give and to pass on the light that she gave us. When I feel grief that she's gone. Just after the period of time, I painted a painting. I didn't bring it because it just seemed like a little not appropriate to, but I painted a painting. I didn't know what it was about. It was two hands, and then there was this kind of ball of light. I had no idea why I painted it, and I took it to my art group, and the hands were dark, but the ball was glowing, and when you held it up to the light, you could see this light glowing through it. And the art group that I'm with said, you know, they sometimes say that when people die, when people pass light on, their hands go dark. So it just sort of gave me the chills, and I thought, yes, that's what she's done. She's passed her light on to us. So I hope that we can catch it and carry it on. So now I want to move on to our second speaker, and I want to give everybody an opportunity to speak. Dorothy Bowman is going to speak next, and then we're going to have Linda Shan, and then we'll have Mike. So, Dorothy, would you like to come up?
There's some water right there. Thank you. Hi. It's so wonderful to see all of Helen's friends here, nurses, and Elise, Chase, and family. It's just wonderful. Anyway, Helen and I share, in fact, the Misers and the Bowmans share a long history here. We both families came in the 60s, and we had young families. They had Paul and Elaine, and we had Dick and Sharon and Gordon. And we grew up together here in the fellowship. And shared, Helen and I are the same age, and we shared birthdays together with Marge Grimm and Adrian Davies. We shared a lot. She also is very talented. She is a sewer. We went to Elaine's wedding when she was growing up, and she made Elaine's wedding dress, and she made her own dress, a mother of the bride. She's a sewer. She made the drapes in the foyer. She is a cook. She loves to try new recipes. She cross stitches. She made a 50th anniversary cross stitch. Patterned for us, and she put on the back number 61. She's done 61 of those for everybody, you know, for all kinds of occasions. So I just think that I wanted to share some perspective on Helen first. And then I wanted to talk about her sex education. She's a sex educator. And the UUA back in the 70s produced this wonderful About Your Sexuality program for teenagers. And Helen and Ed were the first ones to do it here in the fellowship. And it has been extended. I mean, this was in the 70s. And the Unitarians are very avant-garde about, you know, doing things first. And this was a wonderful program. And she and Ed did it. And my daughter, Sharon, who's in her 50s now, was the first one in that program. And then, and Gordon also was in that. And the parents were invited to participate also to find out what the kids were learning. So the parents spent 2 Saturdays learning about the slang expressions for body parts. We learned so much and we had so much fun that we really enjoyed it tremendously and learned a lot from it. And as a result of my new freedom and, you know, feeling comfortable with all this, I went to a male sex striptease here with my daughter and my sister and her daughter. The four of us went. It was in Mayapak. I mean, Helen really encouraged us to do this, you know. Now that you're liberated and you know you're feeling comfortable with this now, you can do that. And we did enjoy it, I must say. So then the second thing is I have a developmentally disabled son, and I wanted the sex education program for him, and he couldn't really participate in this one. So I talked to Helen about what I was going to do. She said she would go to BOCES, where Dick was attending school, and give a workshop there for the parents. And she did that. And she kind of made them aware of sexuality, of retarded people, that they are also sexual. And I don't think anybody in the 70s really thought about that. And at the time, I was a social worker at Keon Center, which is also a workshop for retarded adults. And I brought that to them. And I looked around for a program, and I found Circles. It was a program that was established there. So Helen was my mentor as far as moving into an area that was not really well-known at the time. Nobody really thought about sexuality with handicapped people. And then later, the UUA had another program about sexuality, and they wanted to field test it among all these different churches. So Helen volunteered for this, and we got all these couples from the fellowship. The Leversuches were in it, the McNeils were in it, we were in it. And we field tested this program. We had a lot of fun doing this. And Bob McNeil, I guess some of you know him, he volunteered to do orgasm. So he came in ready to do the orgasm, and he came with a white coat, and he went, the big O, and he had a big O on his shirt. I mean, we will never forget that. So Helen really brought the whole area of sexuality to Helen and Ed both, to this fellowship, to the whole, this was in the 70s when things were really, not a lot was going on at that time. And I really credit her with doing that and making us all aware. And, you know, it's been going now ever since that time. Judy Chavron said her daughter Rebecca was the last class that Helen and Ed did. And then it was taken over by other people. I think Josh, we have a lot of different sex educators now. It's called OWL, Our Whole Lives. and they've developed the program all the way down to five-year-olds. I mean, it really is an amazing thing. So I don't know whether everyone is aware of these programs, but it's wonderful. Anyway, so Helen brought a sense of, you know, raising our consciousness level about sexuality here. And it was very important that we could talk about it without embarrassment. This is what Sharon said. I said, how was that class, Sharon? She said, oh, she was never embarrassed by talking about this class. So anyway, that's what I have learned from Helen, and it's been a wonderful legacy. So thank you.
And now we're very fortunate to have with us Linda Shan this morning. Linda is an RN. She teaches at the College of New Rochelle. She's on the ambulance corps, and we welcome her.
Thank you. Good morning, everybody.
Good morning.
I was babysitting last night with my grandson in New Jersey, and my daughter says, well, why do you have to leave so early in the morning? And I told her why I was coming, and she said, now, how did you get involved with that? And I said, I really don't know, but I've learned through the years to just let it go, and by letting it go, I'm here this morning in this beautiful day with all you wonderful people, so that's where it goes. And I thank Susan for mentioning the 11 Blue Men. I haven't thought about that in years. That was one of the first books I read as a nursing student. It was community health nursing, which was incredibly boring to me then. But that book was fascinating. And like you said about Helen, it made me say, oh, there's more to all this science of nursing than the teachers are portraying. Let me pay attention. And I did. But anyway, I'm very honored to be here this morning to talk to you about our good friend, Helen. The first time I met a Helen, she scared me. I was a new member of the Yorktown Volunteer Ambulance Corps and a new EMT. In fact, I was so new, I was only on my second call and still a probationary member. I was trying really hard to do everything by the book. I always try to live up to my expectations, but as a new member, I wanted to be stellar. The call was for a 10-3 for an MOS. Okay, what did that mean? We rolled up to the house, and there was Helen, the patient, in the doorway, ready to go. She asked, who's in charge? And before I could say anything besides me, she rattled off a physical assessment, medicine, illnesses, and a history of the current problem that was just like the EMS textbooks I had recently studied. So I said, all right, let's go. And let's go, she said. As I started to listen to her heart and take her blood pressure, she told me that she was a professor of nursing and a bit about what she had been doing over her professional career. Okay, now I was really sweating. I am also a nurse and a professor of nursing. Now I was really pressuring myself to be perfect. Helen, as a nurse with excellent assessment skills, easily picked up on my tension. When I told her I was feeling a bit intimidated, she just smiled and laughed in such an easy way that I calmed down, completed my tasks, and spent the first of many discussions talking about nursing over the decades as it has evolved, and the life of a professor, the healthcare system, and the world in general. That day, Helen became a valued friend and a nursing colleague. We had many opportunities to talk because Helen, as corresponding secretary at the Volunteer Ambulance Corps, was often at the Corps. Although not a riding member, she provided a long-standing and essential service to the Board of Directors and the Corps in general. I looked forward to Helen's visits to brighten up my six-hour shift. As Helen's friends, you know that under that welcoming spirit was a determined woman. Without even realizing it, Helen had pulled me into several nursing and community organizations. One group I became involved with was the Funeral Consumer Information Society of Westchester. Participation with this group tied in with the work I was doing in palliative nursing and opened the door to many opportunities and experiences that have since enriched my professional work. I continue to thank Helen for the guidance and mentoring she provided as I moved into a new specialty in nursing. I miss and will continue to miss my friend, colleague, and nursing mentor, and I will always smile when I see the textbook she wrote sitting on my office bookshelf. Thank you all for being here, and I thank Helen for allowing me to be part of her extraordinary adventures.
Oh, there are just so many facets to this Helen Miser, so many facets that we probably could just explore on and on. But our next speaker is Mike Heffernan. And Mike, if you would come forward.
Good morning. I had the privilege, and indeed it was a privilege, of working with Helen on the Finance Committee. It started about 7 years ago. We had hired a minister, but we were trying to figure out how we were going to pay for it. The board had given us a mandate, and they said, get some more money, you know, somehow, some way. And my first idea was to just have everybody raise their pledge 10%. And we're at the meeting, and Pete Smith was there, and he was on board with it. And Geert Bowman, who was also a member, he hated the idea. He just thought this is like the worst idea he ever heard. He had been on the board for many, many years like Helen. And his idea was whatever people are paying, that's what they can afford. And that was that. So Helen became the swing vote, you know, kind of like Justice Kennedy on the Supreme Court. She had it in her hands because we wanted to have sort of a unanimous, this was a new thing in the fellowship. We wanted to have sort of a unanimous front for everybody. And Helen, I think because it was my first idea, she decided to support me. And I think that was just because I was new and she thought I needed the help. So she took Geert aside. And Geert had this strong, he was a strong man. He had his own, he had his ideas on things. And I sort of overheard her saying to Geert, now look, I know what you think, but we want to, you know, we got to be real. We got to come up with some more money. And, you know, I think we just, if everybody in the fellowship, those people who can pay it, will pay it. And those people who can't, they if they can't afford it, they won't. And, she said, "Now come on, Geert. You got to come on board because you know you can keep your ideas, but we want to have a sort of a united front." And with that, with Helen, you know, she was a person who like that ad, and the older people know when somebody speaks, people listen. Well, when Helen spoke, people listen, and in this point in time, Geert had sort of given up on the idea, and he said, "Okay, listen. I'll go along with it for now, but let's see what happens." And you know, Helen was right. We had about half of the fellowship raise their pledges, and the other half paid what they could afford. So, Helen, that's the way she was. She brought this practicality to every decision that she made, every statement that she gave to the fellowship. But she also had this empathy for people. And she had the practicality, those people who can afford it will afford it. The empathy, those people who can't will just pay what they can afford. And so that sort of brought a spirit onto the committee. The four of us were one, and we were sort of rolling along for a couple of years, and then something happened. Claire McNeil came on the committee. And all of you who know Claire, she was mentioned earlier. She was the hardest worker in the fellowship. She was incredibly efficient, And she was great, great for the committee. But she had sort of a steamroller effect, you know, when she had an idea, she would sort of roll over. She didn't have quite the idea that Helen had, where you sort of looked at how this would affect people. So anyway, we're talking about again raising money, more money, and Claire had this idea of what the UUA considered as canvassing. It was a term that I had never heard before, and it was what you did was it was a lot of different churches and do this. They send some people out to your home and start talking to you about what you love about the fellowship. But it really is just like a thinly veiled way of getting more money from the people you're talking to. And so I looked at Pete, and we just sort of looked at each other, and you know, we didn't know what to say. I had had a personal experience in my family with it. My mother, after my father died, moved into a condominium, and she went to the church one day, and about a month later, I go to visit her, and she has this stack of like 52 bills, and it's like half of her income. You know, somehow the priest had gotten out there and had gotten her to do that. So anyway, I look at Pete. Pete looks at me. We have no idea what to do. And Geert, I think his eyes were like rolling back in his head with this with this idea. And so, again, it was up to Helen. You know, we just sort of left it to Helen. And she just looked at Claire and she said, you know, Claire, I'm not sure the fellowship is ready for this. And it's like the first time I ever saw Claire just like look ahead and she said, well, maybe for another year. Well, you know. And so, again, you know, when Helen brought this to you, even when we all were listening, whether it was in a meeting or whether it was for sharing afterwards, when Helen was recognized, like I sat up in my seat because I just wanted to hear what she had to say. And so, again, we have a new committee, we have a new chair, and we're rolling along, and things really worked out much better after that because. Again, Helen was the glue that held us all together. She got Claire to sort of be normal and you know. No, I think Claire would enjoy this. But I worked with Claire for 5 years too, so I also it wasn't just about getting more money with the committee. We also had the task of monitoring our finances, our what we call them reserves, and a lot of the reserves were in our stock. People like 15 or 18 years ago had given stock to the fellowship as part of their pledge, and it was really great for us over the years. It was IBM and McDonald's, and it was just an incredible. We didn't invest it, but we were just monitoring it, and Helen loved this. I mean, she checked the big board every day. I mean, it was like she was maternal about this stock, and she'd see me on Sunday, and she'd say, "Did you see what the stock did this week?" And I would say, "Helen, I don't even know what the symbol for this stock is. I have no idea. I have you to tell me what it's all about." And so, you know, one time we were, it was an end of the year, we were looking at all the finances, and I said, boy, the stock, I think the stock was great this year. I think it went up 50%. And Helen just looked down at a piece of paper, and she says, no, Mike, 56%. You know, she had it right down to the dollar. And, you know, also, incredibly hard worker. For a while, we were doing these pledge dinners. And even though she, you know, had physical problems, she was always the first one to come and set up, and the last one to leave. And it was just a pleasure having her and being able to work with her. You know, and the finance, I'm not an emotional guy. You know, I think they brought me on because that they thought I could do this without feeling bad about it, because it's hard. It's hard to ask for money from people. It's even harder to ask for more money, and I really had no problem with it. But Helen would rein me in, and she had that wonderful quality of being realistic, you know, of saying to Geert, this is the way it has to be. We have to have more money, and also being empathetic, which was everybody is going to pledge what they can afford. And that was what our mantra was for all those years that we worked together. And she was always, I never thought of her as a peer. I always thought of her as an inspiration because she was just a joy to work with. And when I heard that she had passed, I just felt not just the loss of Helen as part of all of us, but, you know, who's gonna help us with this committee? And luckily now we have Christine Lally, who's our treasurer. She had a little bit of dealings with Helen. Jerry has come on to help us with the losses that we've had with Claire leaving and Helen. So I just want to say that those 7 years, whenever we met, it was just like everybody else. Like everybody else has said, it was just a joy to be there. Thank you.
Thank you, Mike. You just reminded me as you were talking of a couple of things. Helen read the New York Times every day. She did not miss one word in that New York Times. I was always amazed if I had been was mentioned in an article, she would send it to me. And I don't know how she had the time to go through all of it, but she did. And the other thing, she ran that tag sale for so many years, and she knew I had this thing about ladybugs. And one day I came, she knew I didn't want to be involved in the tag sale, but she found this ladybug at the tag sale and she gave it to me one day. I mean, it's just an example of this wonderful sensitivity and thoughtfulness and love that she had for people. So I think you can see from what we've said today, the tremendous love and admiration that we all have for her. Incredible. Incredible love and admiration. But now I want to take just, we have some time, and I want to take just a few minutes. If there's anybody in the congregation who would like to say a word, and I'm going to, so you don't need to get up, I'm going to bring the microphone around. So is there anybody that feels they would like to share something?
Hi, I'm Brian. Helen was in many ways a kindred spirit for me because she was one of the few people that I could talk to in the congregation. I'm a professional scientist, so she's one of the few people I could talk to in the congregation about scientific journals and publishing and, you know, what all that is and research. And she understood, and we had, you know, some great opportunities to talk about it. And, you know, she would very often, not proudly, but in her own way, you know, tell me about how, you know, the latest version of her new book was coming out and how excited she was that a new generation was going to be able to learn from it. And that will stick with me forever. The other thing I want to remember for, you know, people in the congregation is that even right up, you know, to just, I think, a year and a half ago, Helen would be willing to take on and carry out little skits up in front of us, right? You know, to motivate us to do different things, to, you know, to illustrate something that's going on in the congregation. And if there was a go-to person to do that, right, it was absolutely Helen. And, you know, there's just a perfect example of her willingness both to participate and also her sense of humor that, you know, she could pull it off every time, no matter what it was.
Good morning. My name is Harriet Tax. I met Helen 44 years ago in September. I taught with her at Western for more than 20 years. She was a mentor. She was a wonderful mentor. She was a good friend. But somebody just said, when Helen speaks, everybody listens. And that was a good part of her legacy, both in the Department of Nursing and to me, personally and professionally. The first time I met Helen was at a faculty meeting, my very first. I was new. I didn't know a soul in the community. I didn't know a soul at the college. And there were a lot of announcements. And one of the announcements was, next Thursday is Jewish holiday. At that time, the college was not closed. But there will be no exams on that day. There will be no new material. And one faculty member, who didn't stay very long, over in a corner muttered, why do we have to do this for so few people? And Helen looked around and glared at everybody and just said, I can't remember what she said, but whatever she said, the room went silent. This other faculty member just looked like, oh my God, who are these people? I loved her dearly. I miss her a lot. I remember so many things that I can't even think about sharing them with the congregation. Thank you.
Thank you. I just loved the way your eyes lit up this morning when I started talking about the 11 blue men. Thank you for sharing that. Social justice, and that was her thing, and I'm sure, I wish you had the words of whatever she said, but I'm sure it was good. Yes.
My name is Mark, and I got to work with Helen on several committees here during my time as president of the Board of Trustees, and Helen struck me as somebody that you went to when you needed somebody who you would tell them what your plan was, and she would look at you and go, all right, yeah, we can make that happen. That's not a question. Helen didn't, I don't think there was a part of her that said, you know, I don't think I can do that. I don't think there was a part of her that would give up on anything like that. The things that really struck me about her was meeting her here, and then a couple years later receiving a picture of her with Ellen standing in Machu Picchu. And I'm like, okay, that's one of those life goals. That's pretty cool. And finding out that she was an Army nurse and knowing that she taught my kids in RE, and I think if there was ever somebody who could have done negotiations with terrorists, I think Helen could have done it. Because if you sent her in there within an hour, they'd be coming out saying, you're right, I'm really sorry about all of this. And Helen would have had a hand on their back saying, it's fine, just talk to the guys as you're going out. She could alternately coddle you and cajole you into doing things, and then every now and then she would look at me with a finger and go, and listen. And that was, I'm sorry. Whatever I did, I own up to it. You got me. Whatever I might have done. I got to drive her up to Connecticut to meet a friend of hers' daughter from nursing school, or from the Army, I believe it was. She got to go and meet this woman's daughter that she had lost touch with, and we wandered through a museum up in Connecticut somewhere, and that's still one of those days that I treasure, just to be on the outside of her meeting this daughter of an old friend. And the drive back and forth to Connecticut, Helen asked me if I would drive her because she didn't feel comfortable driving for the amount of time it was. And I felt honored that she considered me to be a friend, that somebody who with this much, I guess the term is veritas, this much gravitas, would look at me and think that I was worthy of being her friend. And that to me meant a great deal. And I think she's one of these people that we'll miss for years.
Hi, I'm Pam. Helen sat behind me for last couple years, and part of my job was to stay in my chair as she got up so that she could use my chair as leverage. But some of Helen's practicality was so wonderful. When I was leading RE way back when, we would always have some gifts for the teachers who had volunteered for the year. And we've always been conscious of our expenses, so this was something we felt had to be done, but it was money. And Helen took me aside and said, you know, we do this without the gifts, right? It's, you know, we don't need this. You don't have to have a party for us. We would still volunteer. And that was something I always loved, was that heart of practicality, you know, not tradition for tradition's sake, but what really makes sense. But we do still give gifts. And the other thing, I'm glad that Mark brought up the Machu Picchu. Last weekend, Carol and I visited with Geert, and Dorothy and Geert were sharing all the travel stories. So for Helen to have been as purposeful and practical, but also fun-loving and adventurous, and making sure that part of her life was filled, she she seemed to have been a wonderful traveling companion and someone who really enjoyed life. So.
Okay. Well, I think that we are going to... I think we're going to be telling Helen's stories for many, many years to come. And that's the wonderful thing about a person who's had so much effect and so much influence. She will go on living in all of us as long as we're all living, and all the people that we influence as long as they're all living, and on and on and on into the generations. So we now come to the final part of our service, where we have a hymn. And Pam, tell me, how many stanzas of this should we sing? What gift can we bring? I think I might have messed up doing just one thing of Amazing Grace. Okay. Will we just have one closing, just a closing word, and then Mike wants to make an announcement, and then we want to get set up for the luncheon. So should we do all of them? Okay. So the number is 404. What gift can we bring? What gift can we bring?
We invite you to stand as you are willing or able.